This week's episode of Level Up, we are going deeper into the President's State of the Nation address. Last night, President Cupcake spent just under 90 minutes, 6,773 words, and yet, did he really say anything? I've got two friends with me here today who are going to help us look a little closer. You know, my mother-in-law, who is a Tswana-speaking woman, told me about listening and that when you listen, you actually have to listen to the root of the tongue when a person speaks. And I hope you gentlemen were listening to more than just the glib words coming out of the president's mouth. I have got my friend Kaya Setole, who is a wise accountant. It might sound like an oxymoron that, but I love the way that he sees and views our country and the way that he tells us about it. And then to look at him, you may think that he's here to fill the hair quota in the room, but he is not. Mark Oppenheimer is an advocate and a very dear friend who also is not afraid of rattling some feathers, right? So gentlemen, were you listening to what the president had to say, and were you blown away or just so
there's what? A few things that stood out to me in the speech. The one is to take something so shameful and brag about it, which is that 28 million people in South Africa are unemployed and on social grants. That is an absolute travesty. That is a failing of the last 30 years of governance, that you have that many people who are not part of the economy. And then to pretend that it's a good thing that they're on social grants. We'd, of course, prefer it if they were all working. So that's the first thing that I find absolutely shocking. And we should then ask ourselves, why are so many people unemployed? Well, it's because the ANC government has done a wonderful job of restricting access to the economy, of eroding private property rights, of discouraging investment. We see sort of two further moves to discourage investment. So one of the things that South Africa has managed to do for quite a while is, at least in its early years, be the darling on the world stage, to have achieved this incredible peaceful transition. And there's a sense in which we are riding on fumes in that regard, that we are no longer the world's darling. So what does President Ramaphosa say? He says, we will not be bullied. Clear reference to Donald Trump's statements about South Africa behaving badly. That doesn't seem like a good way to encourage further financial investment. And then the next is to brag about our reprehensible case at the International Court of Justice against Israel, after it's been made very clear that the Americans disapprove of this enormously.
Does it matter though? Kaya, what do you think? Were you interested, intrigued, or just another tepid bunch of words?
I think it was mixed, in that there were some very important moments that everybody expected him to say something in response to what has obviously been a very difficult couple of weeks diplomatically. And I think also then the secondary question of, well, now that you're presenting on behalf of a different type of government, what exactly do you amplify and what it is that you emphasize? And does this new government actually have a master plan for how to fix the country's fortunes going forward? So I think that was obviously those big talking points that everybody was keen to sort of try and find out what this the president was going to say in relation to those. And I think obviously the big elephant in the room was the whole question of how to respond to this dual problem of having to be in charge of this big diplomatic mission of the G20 this year, and then having to deal with the president, who's got a very, very different way in which he believes all of these structures and all of these alliances should be managed. And I think the litmus test for this year is definitely going to be how we manage that, because it's definitely become a very, very difficult space to navigate. And I think Ibrahim Rasool is probably going to have to earn his dollars, because every single day he's going to have to find a way of dealing with what is becoming an escalating crisis on the diplomatic front. So I think the president not ignoring that elephant in the room was important, but now we have to actually have to wait and see what those envoys that he threatened to send to the world are going to say, and how they're going to reposition South Africa as a country where people can feel we can engage with rather than alienate.
So fascinating for me listening to him last night is, first, he always tries, and I think when you follow an act like Thabo Mbeki, right, you have to try and create this like big story and prosaic kind of movement. And he tried.
Zuma didn't feel any for that.
Yeah, but Zuma had a lot of laughter to add in it, and he didn't feel meanders were worth anything, you know. But he tried, and last year he talked about Dinzwalo and he tried to make a big kind of 30-year play. This year he spoke about the Freedom Charter and the 70-year anniversary thereof. But then not even halfway, I think by page three, he'd completely forgotten that that's the analogy he was working with. But he tried to do a balancing act between the local stuff and the international stuff. And I want us to talk and focus about the local stuff first. He is, they call it a government of national unity, and I'm still trying to figure out what it means for this seventh administration. And he says that he got everybody's buy-in with what he put out in his spokesperson, put a really lovely little thing on Twitter with the
Teams meeting
that everybody 2 hours before. Do you think he set a vision for what the GNU is going to do this year? And what do you think about what he had to say about his various partners within the GNU and how they are responding?
I think when it comes to the question of the vision, remember, they've been threatening to have a national dialogue. And that national dialogue is supposed to be the point in time at which you move on from the reality that ahead of the general election, everybody had their own individual manifesto. So we do not have a consolidated manifesto of all these 10 parties to say that based on the sum of considerations and resource limitations, this is what we want to do for the next 5 years and this is what the outcomes are going to be. So you end up with some very good sounding numbers, but that really aren't backed up by a visible substance. So he says 3% economic growth. And then the question is, well, what are so attractive about 3%? Is it because the sum of all resources can only get us there? And at 3%, do you deal fundamentally with the type of issues that economic growth is meant to address? So it's always very difficult to try and understand, well, what exactly underpins some of these particular pronouncements. We hear 940 billion rand, which sounds like a good number, except it is the very same government that just a week ago was told that you cannot really arbitrarily exclude people from the 379 grand on the basis that you don't have the money. So we kind of have all of these sum of sound bites, which when you try to cogently try to figure out, well, exactly where we're going and how we're doing it, it's very difficult to know what happens next. And I think the vision of the GNU is still quite elusive to me. I think obviously what they've done is they've spent a lot of time fighting over the question of, well, what should the policy making and law making process be going forward? And they still haven't resolved that. They've also threatened to set together a clearinghouse where all of these disputes are meant to be resolved. They still don't have that. And it's already been, you know, they're well into their first year of this administration. So it can be a bit frustrating to sit there and listen to it, particularly if you remember what has been said in the many speeches that he's had. I think this was his 10th one this year. So if you sort of went back and did an analysis of everything that he said and he's promised, and then you say, well, 10 speeches later, you kind of need to know what actually works, in the sense that once I've said it, I've got enough foot soldiers to execute on it, so therefore it's worth talking about. And there'll be many things that actually he doesn't have the foot soldiers for it. He doesn't have the resources for it. So why does it still keep popping up?
Listen, we went into the speech yesterday with due reports, a report from John Steenhuisen and the DA camp saying that the Bella Bill, they're relooking some of those things in the Bella Bill. And then Marubini comes out and says, we have no side deals. We're not talking about anything. Will this GNU hold? What do you think, Mark?
Well, there's some clear tensions between the visions of the two parties. So, and I say the two parties because really, to be honest, the other parties are largely irrelevant in the GNU. I'm with Jacob Zuma on this, so we should be talking about a coalition. I mean, what are the big achievements of, could we name all the parties first of all? I mean, Al Jamar's in there, right? Have they done anything? You know, we've got a kind of charismatic minister of sports. You've got what, some work in correctional services of the Freedom Front, but largely when we talk about it, we talk about the DA and the ANC and their visions. Now, before entering the GNU, the DA, I would say, sort of look like largely a classical liberal party. Let's say free markets are important. We're, let's say, socially progressive, so we should afford rights to people of all groups. We should address the wrongs of the past, but are very skeptical of certain projects. So fight vociferously against expropriation of compensation, as they should, because that kind of a policy is a death knell for society. They fight vociferously against NHI, and they say that Bella is a very bad idea because you're going to open up the floodgates for removing Afrikaans education, which is clearly the plan adopted by Lesufi, right? Now, what happens once they get co-opted into the government? Well, initially, there's some talk that they're going to follow through with these things. But on expropriation without compensation, the DA has flip-flopped so many times in the last couple of days that it's very hard for their voter base to know what do they actually believe. On the one hand, they say, well, expropriation without compensation is a death knell and really bad. But actually, this legislation isn't so bad, and you're not going to get your property arbitrarily confiscated. And then, you know, once the voters sort of freak out, they say, well, we actually do think this thing is really serious, and getting paid null compensation would be very bad. So you've got those contrasting visions.
On the two, I had my screen, like my split screen, right? So I watched SABC's coverage and I watched some EWN coverage, and both of the camera people on both those channels made a clear point of going to the various DA ministers when he made mention, he spoke about education and he made mention of the Siviwe Khwarobe, who is the Minister of Basic Education, and her implementation of Bella. And Siviwe was sitting just behind John Steenhuisen. And every time they were clapping very loudly and kind of nodding along and really looked like they were on board. So it's not holding, you think?
Well, so here's the question. Something that Helen Zille is very aware of is what happens if you're the minority party who gets into a coalition with a majority. And I think the example that they're thinking about are going to be the Lib Dems and the Tories. Now, the Lib Dems got an enormous number of seats in that election, in about 2010, and they campaigned on the idea that they're going to have free tertiary education. Okay, so what happens? The Tories say, we want you to go out and we want you to make the announcement that we're tripling the cost of tertiary education. Okay, and so they basically come out castrated like a character in Game of Thrones, and they say, we're going to triple it. What happens in the next election? They go from their highest support ever, I think of 54 seats, to 8. So the DA know this. They know that if you cozy up too much to the majority power, you will wind up castrated and lying on the floor bleeding out while your voter base goes somewhere else. And so what we have is this sort of idea of, well, it could be so much worse. The ANC could be in bed with MK and the EFF, and everybody recognizes that those guys are a bunch of like communist fascist lunatics.
Everybody?
They've got a hell of a voter base. Yeah. So you've got between them, what, 22% of the vote? Now, the reason why those parties are supported might not have to actually do with their policies. It might have to do with charisma. But you've got a lot of people who don't like those parties. The mainstream press don't like those parties. The ANC kind of likes to play a little game where they go, well, you know, we can always bring those guys in instead of you. If the DA has any future, it needs to take that chit off the table. It needs to make it seem so repugnant to even suggest that you are going to get in bed with those malicious forces that they can then start moving ahead with
their
agenda.
But in fairness, in yesterday's speech, if we're having a fair conversation about yesterday's speech, the president made very clear acknowledgements of the partners within the GNU, how they are working together and where they are working towards. And as I say, when you see them, what we saw on the telecast is they were all on board. Even afterwards, I saw when he was speaking to Hlabisa, the minister in Coxa, because the president also made quite a big play about working more with traditional leaders. And I wonder if that's kind of trying to break the back of the MK. He spoke about municipality and a new way of financing municipalities. And he spoke about the utilities. One of the biggest problems we have here in Joburg is the water is on and off. Kaya, you're nodding very much like the DA ministers were doing.
So I think we seem to have forgotten that we're dealing with politicians, and hypocrisy is fundamental to who they are. So all that clapping that you would have seen, that's the type of thing that you expect to see from people whose loyalties shift with the changing tides, and that's what all politicians tend to do. I think the big challenge that all of these DA ministers have is a simple question of how do you maintain the view that you still champion particular things and champion particular items that your constituency holds very dear while you're still essentially endorsing what this big player in the room is doing. And I think when we look back at the history of perhaps I think the three most contentious bills we've had since the election, which was Bella, the NHI conversation, and also now this new conversation, it is very clear that the DA is kind of stuck in this corner where they don't want to exit the system because they think the alternative of them being out of government would be worse for everyone. But also they are now being forced to confront some of the more challenging laws that we have. And the reason these laws in particular have taken so long is just because of how polarizing they are. The ANC got away for a very long time with not actually just getting them over the line. And now that they are over the line, it's a question of, well, what does it mean? What happens next? And you see some of these confusing statements that come from the different parties around what is going to happen now that it's here. So what the regulations might be in relation to Bella, what the process might be in relation to NHI, and what the modalities might be in relation to expropriation. These are the things that are obviously going to be a source of great contention amongst these parties. And I think at the end of the day, the calendar keeps moving. And soon enough, next year, it'll be local government election. I wonder what the DA strategy is going to be to re-engage its constituents and say, even though we're part of them, we still object to all of these things. So please endorse us again. It's just going to be very difficult. And you're going to find a space for other parties to say, well, actually, we're going to creep in and step into that territory where the DA is now being forced to be ambivalent, where they cannot be as explicit as they used to be. So that is the price you pay for entering into a coalition of this nature. And obviously for Ramaphosa, it's a win-win game. I mean, this coalition was his great idea. So he put it out there. So even when people say we've engaged, we've deliberated, once he puts a speech out there, that is the final word. So it doesn't matter that you as another party may say, well, actually, if you know us very well, you should know that we don't really agree with that. But hey, now he said it's just a type of eternal confusion and ambivalence that is going to be very difficult for the DA to manage ahead of next year's local government elections.
So it was his big idea, the GNU, and it's probably his big idea to keep him president for a full term. After Nelson Mandela, he's going to be the second president ever to serve his entire term. And I think the GNU might deliver that for him. But did he seem like a man in control? Yesterday, when he was up there on that podium and the various iterations, and we're going to talk about the international stuff just now, did you feel that, yeah, this president has got this? President Cupcake is in charge, he's in control, he's driving the bus, and he knows where the destination is for South Africa, Inc.
I think the impression, sorry, is that he's got them. So he's got them, his cabinet captured. The rest of us, on the other hand, we've learned over the many years to be very skeptical of whatever gets said in these particular conversations. But I think the smiles that you saw from all of them means that he's captured them because, I mean, he's brought them into the fold. Gayton McKenzie was never ever going to be a minister of anything in the absence of such a structure. Al Jamal were never going to be a feature in any governance structure in the absence of this particular coalition that is put together. So he's got them. I'm not sure if he's got the rest of us.
Does he have you?
No, not at all. So part of the problem with Cyril is we've been told this grand lie for decades that Cyril is a man of business because he's very wealthy and he was involved in businesses. Now, which businesses did he start? I can't think of one. I can tell you many he had shares in, but has generated an enormous amount of wealth from other people's hard work. But you're not dealing with a person who's business friendly. If you think about the National Democratic Revolution, now this term was sort of described as only those racists at the Institute of Race Relations would ever say something like the NDR. The ANC don't care about the NDR. It's a bad communist policy from the 60s. 2 weeks ago, Cyril says, we are moving ahead with expropriation of our compensation so that we can achieve the National Democratic Revolution. Okay, this is front and center part of the ANC's idea, which is that you capture as much power as you can. What's nice about the ANC is at least that they play open cards because these things are in their documents. So you engage in a state capture project, you make sure that you're never held accountable for it. You have lots of transparency, but no one ever goes to jail. You get your guys into businesses as possible.
He said yesterday that the state capture, they're making headway, the SIU, they've got money back. He says they're making headway.
Well, the litmus test is clear. Who is in jail?
Yeah.
I'm just saying.
So what you have is someone who's quite good at, let's say, appearing right and actually walking very far left. You know, the ANC get accused of the opposite. But some of the worst policies that we've seen, I mean, EWC, the constitutional amendment, is championed by Cyril. Right? Like NHI, which is a death knell for us. Like if you think that load shedding was bad, life shedding is going to be so much worse. Once the state has total control over private healthcare, and private healthcare, by the way, in South Africa, is some of the best in the world. You know, I think you have people who live in the UK and the States who look at our private healthcare system and say, like, wow, what a dream. You've got so many talented people here. It's actually quite cost effective. You know, couldn't we have more of that? Whereas you spend some time in public hospitals, you know, you realize how dire those circumstances are. So you've got someone who has done a very good job of enriching himself, enriching a very small crew of people, saying things that sound nice that nobody believes. It's astonishing that Cyril is sort of treated at all with any sense of dignity, dealing with someone who's presided over the biggest collapse in the ANC ever, from 57.5% to 40%, and the guy acts like he's got this incredible mandate. Now, you were about to discuss the international stuff. I think there's going to be a very rude awakening, different from the New Dawn. The rude awakening is going to be, we cannot get away with these terribly anti-West policies anymore. First of all, they're bad for South Africans. They are ruinous. There's a reason why we have 28 million people unemployed. It's because of our bad policies. And our spitting in the face of the West isn't going to go very well for us. Now, I saw Joel Pollack speak last night, who's probably going to be the American ambassador to South Africa. And he says, just think about this a little bit transactionally. Why are we friends with you? It's because it's in our interest. You know, South Africa still has some resources. It's still, you know, positioned well on the map. We'd like to have an impact in Africa, but for American interests. And so if you're going to go and attack one of our greatest allies, being Israel, and you're going to rename Sandton Drive, where the American consulate is, to Leila Khaled Drive, a known terrorist, well, we're just going to close down the consulate. You know, we're not going to give you any more money. We're not going to be part of AGOA. So if you want to fall into the hands of China and Russia and Iran, go for it. But that's not going to end well for the average South African. And so I think now there's going to be this choice that has to be made, which is, are we going to walk a righteous path that is aligned with Western interests and good for South African people? Or are we going to betray the South African people for the interests of rogue states?
Good for South Africa is one thing. I mean, I think that there are lots of conversations that can be had about what has worked particularly well in the past 30 years in places like China. You know, as they are surging ahead and the numbers came out, Tesla's numbers came out, and you see what China's doing with their electrical vehicles. But I do also want to talk about this positioning of South Africa, particularly on the continent. One of the reasons South Africa has been so sought after, both by the West and the East, as it were, is because South Africa has historically had quite a loud voice on the continent and has been a big brother to some extent. And we see this huge spat with Kagame saying,
"You're a liar." That's what he said.
And we're not going to allow you to come here and bully us, right? What does that foretell about South Africa and who we are and our role on this continent? Do we still hold that position? And is it really within the interests of all these various players to care about who we align ourselves with? Are there other players in the place?
So I think the fundamental problem is that geopolitics is shifting. It always does. And I think what we need to be able to figure out is what South Africa's principled positions are and whether South Africa can then, you know, explain, articulate, defend, and even, you know, just stand by those particular positions. And I think in some instances, obviously, because the ANC has been in charge for so long, you have some strong overlaps of what the ANC believes then being translated into what the nation must then believe. And I think in instances where pragmatism must prevail, you do need to be able to take a step back and say, okay, what is our role in relation to managing, mediating, and whatever else that emerges from there, and then be very clear about this is what we think works best. And I think the reality here is that the world is becoming so polarized, you are unlikely to be able to pull off this ambivalence for a very long time, because essentially there'll be people on the extreme to say it's either you're with us or you're with them. And I think in instances where that seems to be the way things are, South Africa needs to be able to figure out how to tread on that tightrope. I think it doesn't help when you have Minister Mantashe saying that, oh, let's just stop giving them our minerals. Because I'm like, what on earth does that even mean? Why would you be giving them?
Who's giving anyone anything?
So we're not giving them away. But for him, it's just a very unguided reaction. And you cannot have people in charge of state resources, in charge of state policy, being so reactionary in relation to what is a very difficult conversation. You cannot wish away the West. You cannot wish away the East. It's a matter of where do you find a position that then balances what you need to be able to explain to your constituency and what you think your role should be in the global order. And I think South Africa is really struggling the past couple of years of figuring out where it stands, why it stands, and then being able to say that we understand and appreciate these particular consequences, but we think that this is still the best position for us as a nation.
And again, I ask the question, does our president inspire that kind of confidence, not just in us, but in the other players? He is the president of G20 for all intents. He is leading the G20 this year. Does he inspire that? And when you see him yesterday and as he tries to straddle all of these various things, is he winning or is he just another puppet?
Well, Marco Rubio said, I'm not coming to the G20. That sends a signal. Now, what we're seeing, the American sort of
Marco
sea
Rubio
change.
Tweeted he's not coming.
Yeah. So you've got the Secretary of State of the most powerful nation in the world saying, we're not going to associate with you. Now, that's not just a direct message to Cyril. That's a message to the rest of the West to say, this nation is acting like a rogue nation and we're not going to associate with it until they reform. That signal is, we suggest you don't do that either. Now, think about what's happened over the last 2 weeks since Trump was inaugurated. He's had a couple of very high-profile spats with other countries. So think about what happens with the Colombian president. They start deporting Colombians on military planes. President of Colombia says, we are sending these planes back. We're not willing to accept that it's undignified to do that to our citizens. Trump says, oh, that's very interesting. I'm going to add a 25% tariff immediately. And within a week, it'll be 50%. Colombian president says, oh, sorry, I meant to say that you can use my own private presidential jet to expatriate Colombians. Of course, we'll play ball, right? You have threats on tariffs with Mexico and with Canada. They both blink and they say, you know what? Actually, you're right. We do have a border control problem. We'll send our own soldiers to ensure that fentanyl doesn't come into your country and that we don't have people crossing your border, right? Now, whether you like these policies or not, the point is that he's able to extract concessions from people. In Panama, for example, they...
And Cyril is saying, I'm not blinking.
Yeah, let's see how long that goes for. Now, if he doesn't blink, first of all, what's asked of South Africa? The one is to live up to the dream of Cyril's opening speech. He starts off by citing the Freedom Charter, okay? When the Freedom Charter says that South Africa is a nation for all who live in it, founded on the value of non-racialism, also in our constitution. So what is Elon Musk's main complaint with the South African government? You have race-based laws that you want to take 30% of Starlink on a racial basis. Now, what has Trump just done? He said, we are no longer going to be a nation that prioritizes people on the basis of race. We're going to be a colorblind society, their word for non-racialism. We're going to be based on merit. And he's completely gutting DEI from government and businesses following suit. So Meta's doing it, Walmart's doing it, McDonald's is doing it. These are all guys who are true believers in DEI, basically our version of its BE. And they're saying, if you care about non-racialism, we strongly suggest that you do this. Also, private property rights are the way to prosperity. So when you start confiscating property rights, why would you want to do business with you? So yeah, we can either dig our heels in and say, we're not going to play ball. And we're going to leave ourselves isolated. This idea that South Africa plays this like mediating role.
However, Mark, policy, public policy and foreign policy in particular is a very nuanced game for adults. And you can't articulate it in a tweet. And what is said and what is done and what is eventually signed off are not necessarily always the same things. And as everybody keeps telling us, you fuck around and you find out. I think America and the world at large is beginning to see what fucking around and finding out looks like. Because having a very isolationist president in the USA is creating a bit of instability around the world, where we are sitting with the highest number of armed conflicts around the world today. One of the things that Cyril speaks about it towards the end of his speech, he started his speech with a minute of silence for the soldiers who died in the DRC. And he also talks about silencing the guns. We wake up this morning and we're listening to Guterres talking about how we need to do you know, we need to silence the guns. We're in the in West Asia, as they call it, in Israel and Lebanon and Gaza. We're talking about ceasefires, and yet we have an arms race. Nuclear weapons, Iran. Russia, Ukraine is still ongoing. Xi is building one of the biggest military complexes in the world. This, you know, looks like a war is brewing. And an isolationist America is exactly what it looked like leading up to World War I, which led to World War II. Is that where we're going?
So I'm not so sure. So think about Trump's first 4 years, no new wars. Look at what happens when Biden comes in. You have, as you say, this explosion of conflict. You have them pulling their troops out of Afghanistan. Immediately the Taliban comes back, undoes 20 years of a democratization effort there, sends a signal that America is weak. Russia then feel emboldened to attack Ukraine. You have an intractable war there. You then have a strengthened Iran after the Iran nuclear deal sort of like put back on. Sanctions are removed. Iran is then able to fund Hezbollah, Hamas. You have a huge explosion of violence in the Middle East. Trump comes in. You have a hostage deal. You have a ceasefire. I think that sort of peace through strength approach is the way that you're going to, in all likelihood, silence the guns. I also don't think there's a sense in which America First and isolationism are different. So Trump's very much had a global approach,
And I think there is a conversation to be had about that. But I really don't want to be stuck in Trump and Trump's particular views. I am saying that Cyril Ramaphosa very strongly stands his ground yesterday, where he says, we're not going to be bullied. We want to silence the guns, but we're going to do it on our own terms. And I think for all that it is, one of the things that we have not seen Cyril do in the past is be unequivocal about some of these stances. And when I saw that yesterday, I thought, I wonder how much he's been paid for it and whether he can stand by it.
Look, it was a very brave position, and I think what made it all the braver is, again, Marco Rubio had said what it said, and Trump had said what it said, and Elon Musk had been saying what he'd been saying. So you'd have thought that with the sum of all of those utterances, there would be a question of, well, actually, how do we manage this relationship a bit better? How do we actually deal with some of these very, very difficult conversations that are based sometimes on sound bites? Because then you go back and then you look at the genesis of Trump's tweets and what Musk has been amplifying. And then you say, well, would this actually stand the test of, if we assess it for the truth? And I think the dimensions of truth have been stretched a bit in this particular conversation. So what we need to be able to figure out is, again, what should a president who has now inherited this dual responsibility of having to really run the big global diplomatic agenda of the year under the G20 versus a president who has now come into power and has also now had to contend with one of the biggest superpowers in the world, having a political administration shift, which is quite very vocal in how it thinks we should or should not engage. And that is going to be the litmus test for how well this year goes. And I think obviously he took the position yesterday that I'll be brave and bold and say, this is what needs to be done. But now the real work starts behind the scenes, where those that are responsible for managing those relationships or managing those tensions now have to find a meeting of the minds so that we can proceed. And I think you cannot labor under the impression that you can have two presidents just screaming past each other, whether it's Kagame versus Cyril, whether it's Trump versus Cyril. That's simply untenable. I think the casualties will obviously be the citizens of those countries who now have to deal with the fact that these alliances are being fractured and there are bilateral relationships on many levels. So you're going to have to find a way of saying, okay, let's switch off the X's for a bit. Let us actually have the right conversation and see how far we go. I still think there's hope. And I think also, I think Donald Trump is going to find a new hobby very soon. He finds them every single day, guys. It'll be somebody else next week. It'll be.
I'm not so sure on that front. So there's a view that Trump's got many balls in the air. But on the South Africa issue, you have Marco Rubio on it. And then you have Ted Cruz, who's head of the Africa Committee in the Senate. It's not just Republicans who are concerned about South Africa. I think Democrats are concerned that we've been sidling up to the Russians. This sort of lie that because South Africa was able to have a negotiated settlement that it's this wonderful mediator on the global stage, it's ridiculous. What role have we played to mediate any conflicts? We weren't particularly useful with Russia and Ukraine. We, of course, have exacerbated tensions in the Middle East by rushing off to the ICJ. It's quite clear that we've sort of said, no, well, we're friendly with America and we care about the West, but we've done everything to upset the West. And now the chickens are coming home to roost. I think that it suits the Americans to make an example of us. They've made examples of much closer allies. And if you don't follow through on your threats with us, well, then you demonstrate weakness. And we know the one thing about Trump is he's not very happy to demonstrate weakness. And I think they still have good strategic reasons to have a good relationship with South Africa. I think this is a way to change the conversation. The one thing that Trump's very good at doing is changing the norms. As you mentioned, diplomacy is normally one of those things that's diplomatic and nuanced and soft power, and we have these sort of, you know, subtle conversations and, you know, a couple of winks, and it's all very British. That's not Trump's style. His style is, I'm going to slap you in the face as hard as I can, and now you're going to wake up and you're going to see that you're living in a new dawn, and the terms of negotiation are going to be very different. And you can either embrace that reality or not, but the costs of not embracing the reality are going to be severe. Now, what's interesting, of course, is who bears the brunt of it. As you point out, it could very well be ordinary South Africans, which would be an absolute shame. If we lose out on AGOA benefits, there's about 250,000 jobs in South Africa that are AGOA dependent. Now, Kali Creel at AfriForum has said, well, you ought to rather punish the particular politicians who are behind these bad policies, you know, have targeted sanctions against ANC officials. And that might be something that gets considered.
Yeah. And again, I think, you know, the nuance in all of these conversations, one of the things that we've seen with Kali's problem and positioning over the past week is the loss of that nuance, right? Is having to dial back what they've spent the past 4 years, literally spending all that money going over to America and drumming up support on their cause. And now that fuck around and find out, they're finding out what it looks like coming back over the sea, and now they're having to dial back. So, you know, unfortunately, the Kali situation. But hold on, I just want to say this, because I do think that the jobs issue, two of the things that I was looking and listening out for quite hard yesterday is because I really do care about South Africa and South Africans and our, you know, kind of standard of living. So I really wanted to hear the president talk more about the economy and talk more about jobs. In his over 6,000 word speech, he literally mentioned the word jobs 9 times. Economy, because he talked about kind of wind, energy and all of that kind of stuff, that kind of goes up to about 29 times, but also health and the health sector. And there are a couple of bills coming up this year that, again, he only spent about 3 minutes talking about health, talking about the NHI, and not much else about what ordinary South Africans are worrying about on a day-to-day basis. Looking forward into this year, some of those bills that are sitting in the queue for him. One of the other contentious ones that's coming up is the tobacco bill, and that'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Do you think he spent enough time thinking and talking about who bears the brunt, the South African citizens? Because he did position himself with all of these other things, but was he caring about us in his speech yesterday?
Look, if you are the president of a country where 28 million people are directly dependent on state transfers just to live, and you've got an unemployment crisis, I think it's around 32%, and you've got a growth crisis, I think in his term, it's averaged at around 1%, you kind of need to understand that in the absence of an economic blueprint, every single one of your speeches has got that glaring gap in it. And that's the gap that, if you address it, has got, I think, the widest intersectional benefits for society at large. So if you have a properly functioning economic system, you are able to fund even some of the most ambitious ideas that you have, whether it's, you know, social protection, whatever measures that you have. And I think whenever you listen to a speech and you can see that as a glaring gap, it becomes very clear that none of the other ambitions are actually going to be adequately funded in the absence of this revised economic blueprint. And I think we've spent 30 years trying to extract from an inherited economic system, which is clearly no longer fit for purpose for the size of the population that we have and for the needs and the demands of that particular population. And for me, the absence of that particular new economic blueprint that then acknowledges that we've had 30 years of stagnation in so many levels when it comes to the economic dimension. That for me is always the big glaring problem. And I think this speech didn't make me feel that now we finally have it. I just don't feel that.
There's one small recognition, which is Cyril says, we're going to allow multiple people to generate electricity and sell it. Now, that idea, which is once you've dealt with years and years of load shedding and economic contraction because of that and enormous amounts of suffering, when the lights go out, I think everybody has a little moment of like PTSD. But that idea of saying the state actually does this terribly, we should retreat and we should allow the private sector in because they do things very well, that principle needs to be embraced across the board. The private sector in South Africa is phenomenal, especially given the difficult environment in which it operates. But our services are good quality, they're affordable, they're competitive. You want more of that and you want less government. I'm okay with a GNU that passes no new laws. I think that would be wonderful. I think it would be very hard to point at legislation passed over the last 10 years where we go, wow, that was fantastic. I'm so glad we passed that law. Most of the time it's pernicious. I think one way in which
pernicious smug.
Yeah, sinister, nauseating. I don't know how many more words you want to sort of describe that. I mean, we have a very rich common law system. And so if law develops through the wisdom of interactions in court, in other words, you have judges who sort of see facts colliding and then are able to develop the law in a slow way, most of our common law principles look very similar to what you find around the world in Western countries. And those common law principles mirror justice quite well. What we've unfortunately found, and you saw Cyril not mention the justice system at all, is our judges are under enormous amounts of pressure. So in Johannesburg, for example, the busiest court in the country and probably one of the busiest courts in the world, a huge commercial hub, they're at least short of 20 judges. They're in a building that's in trouble. You know, you're surrounded by fire hazards around you, that many lawyers no longer want to go in town because they're worried about being hijacked. We've had an open shooting in court. People being raped in the parking lots close to court, people not wanting to put their hands up to be judges. But that part of the system is so important, partly because it unlocks economic potential. When you have disputes that need to be resolved, you need to know that you can go to a court, that it can be done expeditiously with someone who understands the law. And unfortunately, you know, I remember going to a News 24 conference last year. They said, you know, South Africa is in a really bad place. Basically, everything is failing except for two things. The wonderful press and our glorious judicial system. And a very well-known journalist came up to me and said, you know, Mark, I've got to tell you, things in the press are not looking so good. You know, we've got juniorization in the newsrooms. There's people taking bribes. There's political bias. And he says, but the courts, right? Things are going well. I said, well, let me tell you, we've got some serious problems.
I love that you see a glaring omission with the courts and the judicial system, and that you see a glaring omission with accounting and the money and where the money is going to come from. And that's why we try and get people in the show that come from very different worlds to have this kind of conversation. But if there's one thing that Cyril, outside of your area that you look at all the time, that you feel Cyril could have spent time on, and it would have given South Africans a light that says, it's okay, he may feel this way, this is all the things that are happening, but if he'd concentrated on this and given us direction on this, maybe we're not lost. Is there anything like that for you, that you felt, if he'd done this, maybe we'd feel a little bit, a little poem, a little song? Could he have done anything differently yesterday that would have made you feel better about where we are and where we're going?
So the one question is, there's a difference between doing and saying, right? So I think all of us have expressed a lot of doubt about the levels of honesty from Cyril. As you mentioned, Paul Kagame says, you're a liar. And it's sort of almost like you've been gaslit by your romantic partner for years and someone else sort of like calls them out and you go, oh, you're right, I have been gaslit. This person has been lying to me. Oh my goodness, thank you for pointing that out. So I'm not so sure there's anything you could have said. We would have said, you know what, that's great. What you want to see is action. And the actions are devious. They're counterproductive. They're putting the country backwards. So, yeah, I mean, you can say as many nice things as he wants, but you need to see some demonstrable change.
Sure.
I think one of the key challenges that we have is that obviously for citizens, the primary interaction with government happens at local government level. And that has clearly been completely eroded over many years. The capacity is not there. The size and the structure is completely wrong. And obviously the funding model is simply just not viable at all. So I think in a conversation of that nature, you want to get a break away from the old habits of saying that, no, no, we're working on it, we're going to fix it. You want someone to confront the elephant in the room and say that part of the reason we've ended up with these particular problems is because we've been deploying the wrong people in order to, who have then ended up in these particular structures and completely undermined the entire ethos of what we're trying to do as a party and as a government. And I think what we want to be able to hear as citizens is how you're going to decisively break us away from the shackles of the incompetence that you see. So when you drive around Johannesburg, for example, I think there is this wonderful Twitter account that shows you a contrast of what things used to be a decade ago and now. And you can clearly see that the decay has been accelerating in recent years. And that is a question that somebody cannot shy away from. You have to be able to say, but how did it get here? How did we get to this particular level where we once claimed to be a world-class African city? I don't know who came up with that marketing pitch, but they deserve to be paid very well because, dear God, it was a lie, wasn't it?
Which we bought into. Gentlemen, as always, I absolutely love and appreciate all the new information that you add to my life. So thank you for coming through, and I hope that people that are listening in will go and find you off Twitter now.
Yeah, at some point in time, you have to look around and say, how do I interact with people with such
so much
weird,
where do people get to interact with you? This is your ad. This is your ad break.
Social media is no longer it for me. Hey. I don't know. I'm just not feeling it these days. Maybe I'll come back, but yeah. So at this stage, it's just become a very, very tricky space because I'm just not sure what we're trying to do, what we're trying to achieve with those instruments. I think they were good at some particular point in time, but these days, nah.
Well, I hope you'll come back and chat with us so that people can hear some of the things that you're thinking about. Mark, people can get you on your podcast?
Yeah, so check out Brain and Devat. We're on YouTube and on Spotify. It's a philosophy discussion show. If you want to see some of the work that I do, there's a Mark Oppenheimer YouTube channel that has lots of excerpts of my cases and interviews on Cliff Central over the years as well.
And if you're not part of Psyche, I don't know where people get to go and see you talk.
I'll be on TV once in a while. I'll try.
You'll be here at Level Up, gentlemen. Thank you for your time. Thank you for coming through and leveling up with us. And next week, we're talking about the budget. But I don't think I'm going to have an accountant. I want to hear other people and what they think about what and whether we can finance all these ambitious plans that the president spoke about yesterday. See you next time.